Our wedding was a few weeks away, and I had, as usual, put off preparing until the last minute. I had a fellowship at the time at the New York Public Library in Midtown, and I must have Googled wedding rings near me. Macy's it was. All around us on 34th Street, people were shopping and hurrying and driving and honking. Emily told me, and I thought, okay, here we go. We are going to have a kid. Then I thought, we need to get some very cheap wedding rings at Macy's. I was born in Moscow and came to the United States with my parents and older sibling when I was 6. I grew up in a suburb outside of Boston and found it boring and dreamed of leaving to become a writer. After college, I moved to New York and worked odd jobs and wrote short stories, which I sent to literary magazines, which never wrote me back. To see my name in print, I started doing journalism. I found I really liked it. I also started translating things, stories and oral history, poems, from Russian. Traveling to Russia and seeing its version of capitalism up close converted me to democratic socialism. Eventually, I started a left-wing literary magazine, N Plus One, with some friends, published a novel, and traveled as much as possible to Russia to write about it. This was a decent literary career, truly more than I ever could have hoped for, but it did not bring in a lot of income. When Emily and I met, I was living with two roommates in a grand but ancient and cockroach-infested apartment on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. At the time, Emily was a writer for Gawker, a media gossip website. She was brilliant, beautiful, and very funny. She could also be very mean. She had grown up in an upper-middle-class household in suburban Maryland, but she had a chip on her shoulder. She was also a very good cook. We dated for a while, broke up. She dumped me at a Starbucks in Cobble Hill that later closed during the pandemic, and then started dating again. Eventually, we moved in together to an apartment above a bar in Bedford-Stuyvesant. By this point, Emily had quit working for Gawker and published a well-received book of essays. With her best friend Ruth, she started a small feminist publishing house, Emily Books. She worked for a while at a publishing startup, then got sick of it. The year she got pregnant, she published her first novel, Friendship, about two best friends whose relationship is disrupted when one of them gets pregnant. I was working on my second novel about Russia and had received a year-long fellowship at the New York Public Library to research and write it. The fellowship was the bulk of our income that year. Strictly speaking, we still didn't have much money, but that was okay because we also didn't have any kids. Now, at Macy's, we couldn't get the attention of the saleswoman in the giant ring section. I would have hung around until she got to us, but Emily looked disappointed. The mother of my child. I couldn't make her wait. We got on the subway to Brooklyn and bought rings above our budget at a cute little store in Williamsburg. I suppose it isn't exactly true that I hadn't thought about kids. I hadn't thought about actual birth or what sort of clothes a baby wears or about the practicalities of early infancy. As a child, from the moment I gained some understanding of what it entailed, I worried about childbirth, writes Rachel Cusk in A Life's Work, her dark, brilliant memoir of motherhood. She feared its pain and its violence and what would happen on the other side. To this, truly, I had given zero thought. But I see in retrospect that I had spent years steeling myself for the eventuality of a family. I had imbibed the heroic male literature of family neglect. Henry James, who skipped a family funeral because he was finishing a story. One has no business to have any children, one of his characters famously says. I mean, of course, if one wants to do anything good. Philip Roth, who refused to have children. Tolstoy, who had many children and a long marriage, but who still managed, at the very end of his life, to walk out on them. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote beautiful letters on life and literature to his daughter, Frances, but only after Zelda had been committed to a mental institution and Fitzgerald himself was floundering in Hollywood. The intellect of man must choose, William Butler Yeats had written, perfection of the life or of the work. I would choose the work, I told myself over and over. I had been married once before while still in college, and at the time I was adamant that the relationship must not interfere with my writing. My time must be my own. I must have adequate amounts of it. If my writing does not get done, then all is lost. My insistence on this eventually doomed the relationship. We broke up. The lesson I took from this was not that I should keep things in perspective, but that I should arrange my life so it revolved wholly around literature. In the pages of N Plus One, I pledged never to teach writing, or to write for money, or to do anything else to distract from what I thought of as the highest calling one could have. One time, not long after Emily and I started dating, I hosted the Russian writer Ludmila Petrushevskaya in New York. With Anya, my ex-wife, I had translated a book of her scary fairy tales, and Petrushevskaya, by then in her 70s, flew over to do some readings, shop for clothes for her kids at Century 21, and eat Thai food. She was, and is, in my opinion, the greatest living Russian writer.